This program is brought to you by Emory University.
Thank you. So we're going to proceed with our second talk of the afternoon. We're very pleased to have Michael Arbib with us. Michael is a university professor emeritus and professor emeritus of computer science, biomedical engineering, biological sciences, and psychology at USC. He published his first book in 1964. With a title that fairly well summarizes his interests to this day, Brains, Machines, and Mathematics. His research has long included a focus on mechanisms underlying the coordination of perception and action, and his group prepared the first computational model of mirror neurons and conducted some of the key initial imaging studies of the human mirror system. He continues to develop insights into the monkey brain and use them to chart the evolution of the human language-ready brain. 2012 saw the publication of his 40th book, How the Brain Got Language, The Mirror System Hypothesis, which he followed in 2013 with an edited volume, Language, Music, and the Brain, A Mysterious Relationship. In 2016, he came out with a textbook from Neuron to Cognition via Computational Neuroscience. And more recently, the journal Interaction Studies published a special issue in 2018 that he edited based on a workshop that he organized called How the Brain Got Language Towards a New Roadmap. So I think he's going to pick it up from there.
Thank you. So I shall assume you've read all the books and build on that. No, I think I'm all right. Now, I have to apologize. You've just seen these wonderful videos. No videos. I'm sorry. Okay, so there are going to be two themes in this talk. One is just to briefly recapitulate some of the ideas in this book, How the Brain Got Language. And the idea is going to be this sort of interplay between biological and cultural evolution. So the idea that what early Homo sapiens had was not a universal grammar in the sense of Chomsky, but rather a brain that, over following tens of millennia, led to the development of language. And so proto-language will be my term of art for something between what other primates can do today, and which presumably we shared with their distant ancestors, and language. And I'll say more about that. And then I'm going to claim that once you have this basic capability in place, what I'll call a language-ready brain, then getting towards full languages as we know them today as a matter of cultural evolution. So that will be theme one. Oops, wrong button. But fortunately, it doesn't do any harm. So theme two is going to be the idea that if you have a brain that is language-ready in the sense that I'm talking about, it's also construction ready in senses that I'll describe. And so I'm going to be inspired in part by what you've just learned from Dori Fregasi on monkey tool use manipulation. I'm going to refer a little bit to the work of our distinguished chairman, Deet Stout, on human tool use. And of course, a whole series of lectures could be given on the relation between the monkey and the human studies. I think I have two whole slides on this. And then finally, in preparation for the third talk on bird nest construction by Sue Healy, and I have coined a new word, speculation, because the Latin for hand is manibus and the Latin for beak is becus, so from manipulation to speculation. And the hope is in some way we can create a convergence between these studies of construction in human and birds that are at least as informative as the studies underway now to compare bird song and speech production. So that's the general framework. Oh, I keep doing it. All right. So this is, well, really the point is the quote at the top from Hansel and Ruxton, who view tool behaviors as a subclass of construction behavior. And I think Dori would argue that construction behavior is a subclass of tool use. But anyway, the suggestion here by comparing this wonderful New Caledonian crow on the left, who uses, in the wild, uses a serrated leaf to get twigs out of a tree, and who, in working for her degree in Oxford, was able to bend a piece of wire to retrieve a little bucket from a tube to get food. And that's sort of wow. Who knew that a bird could use tools so brilliantly and even make a novel tool to do it? And yet when you look at this African mask weaver's nest, you've got to say, hey, that's pretty impressive too. So that's why in the end I would like to see these two studies of tool use and construction come together. But the punchline at the end will be non-human primates are really poor at construction. So maybe we've got to go to the birds after all. Okay, now I'm going to use construction in two very different ways. So one is the more perhaps obvious use, and the one that fits in with the bird nest stuff, the practical skill of constructing more complex objects from simpler components. But I'm also going to use it in a technical sense that we use within language. There are some people who don't approve of Chomsky who call themselves construction grammarians. And the idea is we put words, how does language work? Well, basically, you've got a stock of words, the lexicon. And the great thing about language is we can say new things all the time and hope they will be understood, as I hope is happening with the novel sentences you're hearing now. So let's look at that idea of construction in more generality before we jump into theme one and then theme two. So here is a wonderful example of construction in the human sense by the Swiss architect Peter Zumthor. He was basically given the charge, here we are in this valley in Switzerland, there are lots of thermal pools here, build a building around them. And I have a whole talk on design of buildings and architecture and the trade-off between the function and the aesthetics of the thing. But the point simply is just to show here is a masterpiece of construction that humans have achieved, and one can wonder how one gets there from early primate beginnings. But I want to introduce Peter Zumthor himself and a couple of quotes, and I'll come back to him towards the end of the talk in part two. Construction is the art of making a meaningful whole out of many parts. I feel respect for the art of joining. What he's saying is that even though he's not building the building himself, he is, when he designs, he is thinking about the various crafts that must be mobilized to build the actual building. And his respect for that informs the design to yield the overall effect. Now, construction grammar, this example, is to show the idea that if you take sort of abstract grammar, there are things like how do you put adjectives and nouns together, or how do you arrange subject, verb, and object. But the point here is that there are both very general constructions and very focused constructions. So if you want to elaborate the sentence, the woman is hitting a man, we can use the fairly sophisticated relative clause construction to tell us what more about the woman by saying the woman who is wearing a blue dress. So we're adding this who is wearing a blue dress, the relative clause. But we can also use a very idiosyncratic construction, the person in color construction, the woman in blue. And there, it's not that she's in a pool of blue paint or anything of that kind. She is wearing a garment, and the garment is blue. And that's the... And what's interesting here is that in when we talk about linguistics in general, we often think only about these very generic constructions. So who is wearing a blue dress? There's a, you know, who, and then a verb thing, and then a noun phrase, and you put them together. So you're talking about abstract syntactic categories, whereas the person in color construction is very specific. You need generally a person, because they're what wear garments, and you need a color. So that there you've got semantic categories rather than very abstract syntactic categories. And from someone like myself trying to understand the evolution of language, it's great if you can tell a story which goes through sort of constructions that relate to limited domains of everyday experience rather than think immediately, oh, somehow our brains have machinery for abstract nouns and abstract verbs and how to put them together in very, very general rules. So that's the sort of burden of this. And here's the contrast between Chomsky and those of my ilk. So for Chomsky, the idea is that you look at syntax, the sort of the abstract version of words, what I caricature as the cheerleader theory of grammar. It's not like, give me an S, give me an N, give me a V. And then that way you build up a sentence by putting abstract category labels together. And only at the end you say, oh, well, now I have a syntactic structure. Hey, maybe we can pronounce it, phonology component. Oh, maybe we can mean something with this. And I don't like that idea. So in the construction grammar is sort of the idea I tried to give you with that previous slide. You're trying to convey a meaning right from the start, and then you're finding the constructions, whether very focused or very general, that will let you assemble from a suitable lexicon the items in a way that will convey your desired meaning. In this case, what is it I want to tell you about the woman? Not just that she's hitting a man, but something about her. Okay. So that's the background. Now we can talk about the language-ready brain. I was talking to some colleagues the other day, and maybe the languages-ready brain is better, because I think if you're thinking about the evolution, it's not that somehow humans came up. I think there was a Larson cartoon about this where, you know, they suddenly say, "Oh, gosh, from now on we can use grammar," but rather, you know, they found slightly more elaborate, slightly more ad hoc ways to communicate about particular activities that were important in their daily lives. And only much later, after tens of thousands of years, you get to the stage where you generalize across these different special purpose constructions. Anyway, so the starting point for me is going to be the fact that for many people, when they talk about language evolution, they conflate it with speech evolution. But I observe that no other primate has flexible vocal control and learning. They have some innate calls with some experiential tuning, but that's it. But all have manual dexterity and the ability to acquire new skills. So I am part of the community that believes that manual gesture provided essential scaffolding for the emergence of language. And then once we had enough brain power, as it were, to assemble arbitrary gestures to convey meaning, then we could begin to have an adaptive pressure for increasing vocal control to bring vocal gestures into that repertoire. So, and then my slogan of language ready, language readiness, what evolved biologically but involves some cultural evolution is language readiness rooted in the linkage of vocal and manual gestures. So the idea is, when we look at the details, manual gestures really get the machine going, then vocal gestures come into way, pantomime helps to support communication. So being language ready rather than having language or using language. And the general framework you may have heard of is the Evo-Devo framework, that evolution doesn't give creatures that are formed as adults, it gives creatures that in a normal environment will develop to be adults who can behave in certain ways. And what we're adding and what we've seen very much discussed in Dory's talk is there's a social component too. What happens, and as she has mentioned to me when I asked her, but I don't think it was explicit in the talk, is that if you go around that area, you'll find communities where they do use the nutcracking and communities where they don't, correct? So that there's really a social component. You grow up in this group, you end up cracking nuts. I don't know what the kids do for entertainment if they're not in a nutcracking group. Check that when you go to Brazil next week. But anyway, see, research is underway. Isn't it exciting? All right. So just as a comparison point, I think we all agree that humans did not evolve biologically to be able to read and write. And it's very interesting. Then we can sort of make as our comparison the reading-ready brain. And the interesting point is that two French scientists, Dien and Cohen, have done brain imaging, which both specifies, as we knew, that the brain of a literate person is different from the brain of an illiterate person. And they have found an area that lights up most strongly in fMRI for detecting the visual form of words, And the claim is that this co-opts part of the circuitry that evolved perhaps for face recognition. So you have what looks like, if you only did your scanning in literate people, you might think, oh, evolution has given this area. But then when you step back and compare it with illiterate people, you say, oh, evolution has given us an area that can be co-opted to discover and then disseminate and teach kids about reading. Okay. Anyway, the framework for my work, until I gracefully hand over the podium to Sue at the end, will be comparative neuroprimatology. In other words, what can we learn about ourselves and what can we hypothesize about our evolution by comparative study with extant primates? And in particular, the comparison with the apes and the closest ape relatives of the bonobos and chimpanzees, or the comparison with monkeys. And because of my colleagues working with macaque monkeys, I know more about them than other monkeys, especially what's going on in their brains. But just a little jargon, LCAM, last common ancestor with the macaque, and last common ancestor with the ape or the chimpanzee, 5 to 7 million years ago, 25 million years ago. And so trying to come up with an evolutionary theory of our capability, and in particular our capability for language, it's sort of a double game, right? Because both you're saying, given the diversity of ape behavior today, given the diversity of monkey behavior today, what possibly can we safely infer about the properties that were already in place 25 million years ago? Given all those apes, what can we suggest in place? So there's a debate going on about, are you really sure that our ancestor already had this? Then we have that other thing of, well, what were the evolutionary pressures that get us from one stage to another? And one critic of my theory said that I was postulating a miracle. And my response was, well, actually, I'm trying to break down one miracle into several smaller miracles in the hope we finally get down to what we can manage. Okay, now, this actually is not part of what's in the book, and it's even flakier than what I'm going to tell you later. But I think somehow it introduces some ideas in a way that you might find helpful in thinking about what I'm going to come up with next. So as you know, the classic thing about monkeys is that they have alarm calls. In particular, the vervet monkeys have three alarm calls, one for a leopard in the vicinity, one for an eagle in the vicinity, and one for a snake in the vicinity. And The interpretation for the leopard call, if we tried to express it in its richness, I think, would be there's a leopard nearby, danger, danger, run up a tree to escape, and it will probably add, and spread the news, so other monkeys will take up the call. Okay, the first monkey to see the leopard utters the call is then contagious, other monkeys both utter the call and seek to escape. And it doesn't seem to tell you where the leopard is or anything, but you know that running up a tree is a good thing to do. Now, there's, you know, again, almost every slide here, there's an hour's worth of discussion, but we're just going to take it at that for now, and maybe somebody will ask the question which allows me to say more. Now, what I'm going to suggest is that, through reasons I'll sketch later, as we humans developed to the point where we began to scavenge, and began to have ways of conveying new meanings to each other, my suggestion is that what first emerged might have not been like, I have words for all these things, and I will put them together. I'm going to suggest that's a later stage. And what, in the first place, was a bit like what the monkey has. It's putting all those things together. There's a leopard nearby. There's danger. You've got to escape. And all that's combined with it. And notice, you couldn't use the leopard call as the word leopard. And we say, oh, look, there's a dead leopard, let's eat it. Well, you only say that using the leopard call for leopard if you want to eat it all by yourself, right? As you fool all the others into running up the tree while you get on with it. But so there really is, I think it's very important. People say, well, you know, if I were to shout out the word leopard, you'd figure all the rest out and respond accordingly. But shouting out the word leopard in that context is not the same as being able to use the word leopard to construct sentences as part of a language. That's the essential thing. So therefore, what I'm saying is, here's a paraphrase of, you might also develop a novel, socially developed modulation of noise or modulation of hand gesture, which says there's a dead leopard, let's feast on it. But what I'm emphasizing is, this is a unitary utterance in the same way the call is. So let's go through that. It has no subparts whose meaning can be separated from the whole, and the meaning of the whole cannot be reconstituted from its subparts. So I'm going to suggest that the proto-language stage, what we had in ways that I'll try to sketch later, lots of things like this that we could break into words as we express them, but which would not be broken into words in our distant ancestors. Now, there's a woman who was at Durham, now in Newcastle, called Maggie Telemann, who sort of mocked this idea. You said, well, how could that be? You know, how could we have this? But just consider the words you use. Consider the word eat. I mean, to make any sense of that, you have to unpack so much more so that, but you know, you want to unpack, let's say, eat from digest to, and so on, and then you have to have more words or more elaborate structures in which to clarify the distinction. So that's sort of the idea I'm trying to get together. So I'm going to say, I'm trying to get across the idea of a proto-language and a proto-word, a sort of competing thing would say, somehow you get nouns and somehow you get verbs, and then you learn how to put them together. The counter argument here would be, no, you have ways of expressing what's really important in your group, and it's only later that you build on that to discover ways of teasing apart different components. And then, once you've done that, you're at the same time finding constructions to put them together again in novel ways to express new meanings. So, so I think, you know, you'd need another one, perhaps, that as you become hunters, you'd have something like, there's a leopard, but let's hunt it so we can feast upon it. And there may be, at the beginning, nothing in common between those that corresponds to leopard. And that would only come later. So I've got one sort of modern example of conventionalization. I'll be talking about pantomime later, so let's do it here. If I do, what's that pantomiming? Thank you so much. And if I do this, okay, what's in common between the two? Just this. And that might therefore become the new symbol for door, even though it's in no way a symbol for door. It's just part of a pantomime. Once you break it in that part, then this can become the symbol for open. This can become the symbol for close. And now, if there are other things, if I go saying, shut your mouth, okay? All right. Okay. But how did the brain get ready for all this? So I'm just reemphasizing, monkeys have species-specific innate vocalizations. Apes have, in addition to their vocalizations, they have communicative manual gestures. And it does appear that, in addition to whatever might be innate, they can build new ones. And here's an important distinction. Some people say, well, apes can learn language because they've been taught some signs of American Sign Language. But in fact, they never get beyond learning a few signs. They don't ever get grammar. And a language without grammar is not a language in the sense that I'm using the term for today's discussion. Okay. So let's go back to the macaque monkey and start building the case. So, as Magritte would say, this is not a brain, but it is a representation of a macaque brain. And there's an area back here, and don't worry too much about the terminology, but it's the anterior intraparietal sulcus. All it means is there's a groove in the parietal lobe, which is this region, and it's the part to the front, the anterior part of the intraparietal sulcus. And what my friend Hideo Sakata in Tokyo found was that if he put electrodes in that part of the monkey brain, what seemed to be there was the classification of neuron, a classification of objects that the monkey was looking at, not in terms of what they were, but how to grasp them. So in other words, if you see a small cube and a small sphere, there's no difference between them. You're going to use a precision pinch for each of them. So there you wouldn't see a difference. Whereas other workers had gone down into this area called the infratemporal cortex, IT, and had, monkeys had IT long before we did, had got into this region and found that there the classification was for objects. So there you would get a different response for the cube versus the sphere, even though they were to be grasped the same. And so the notion is that this area is the one that takes visual information and shoves it over to the manual control system. So F5 is just an area in the frontal cortex. It feeds into F1, which is the primary motor cortex. This is the terminology of this group in Parma, led by Giacomo Rizzolatti, and then that heads down to motor control. So this notion, and here's that word you heard already from Dori, the affordances. You're looking at objects not in terms of how you'd name them or anything of that kind. You're looking at them in terms of what are their affordances for, in this case, grasping actions. And then this has to go to the area that elaborates the motor commands in a way that can be read out through diverse brain areas by the primary motor cortex. Now, in humans, something like this dichotomy has been observed as a result of brain lesions. So Jenner et al. Found a woman who had this path up through parietal cortex damaged. And what was interesting with her is that if you showed her an object, I think cylinders are good because this totally, knowing it's a cylinder is neutral about how big the cylinder is. So show them a range of cylinders of different sizes. And this person could not root the observation of the size into manual control. So she'd keep her hand out until she hit the object, and then she'd close. Whereas all of us would go like this, getting approximately the right separation before we made contact. On the other hand, if you said, well, how big is it? She could tell you. And she could even pantomime how big it was. So she had this rough information about the size of the object that she could communicate in language or in pantomime. In a communication system, she could declare the information, but she couldn't route that information to, and again, there's some qualifications here, but not for the moment. Whereas this other patient, observed by a Canadian, an English group, Scottish group, who had a lesion here, she could, sorry, we're doing this right way around. Yeah, she couldn't verbalize the size, but she could, or even pantomime it, but she could use it as she reached out. So how big is it? Oh, could be a centimeter, could be, no correlation when you put the declared width against the actual width, but when you look at the pre-shape before hitting the object, beautiful regression. So we talk, as a result of that, we talk about the dorsal pathway up here through the parietal lobe as being the how pathway. It sort of says, what are the details you need for motor control of an action? Whereas if we go this way, the suggestion is, it's what do you need to figure out what objects are as part of planning what the action will be. And so we developed a computational model, and I'm not going to go through it in detail, but this sort of gives you an idea. There's looking at this, the idea is that the dorsal stream can look at the various surfaces and come up with, oh, here are ways this object could be grasped. But it doesn't know what the object is. This pathway through IT, you can say, oh, that's a mug. Right. But what are you going to do? So the idea is that you need prefrontal cortex with working memory and other things to say, oh, I need another shot of coffee. That's motivation. I remember there's some coffee in the mug. That's working memory. And on that basis, I will bias the system towards the handle. And then that's the one that goes through premotor and motor cortex to yield behavior. Whereas, if I just, that damn mug's on top of that book I need to look at, then that might yield, let's just grab it this way and move it across the table. So the idea is that there are these two streams, but in general behavior, they interact. The plan, the planning of what to do next says, which affordance at a sort of cognitive level do you want to exploit? But then it's up to the dorsal system to convert that cognitive decision, whether it's conscious or not, into the details that will convert the visual information into the actual muscular dynamics that will yield the behavior. Oh my God. All right. So the next step, mirror neurons. These are some of my colleagues in Parma who discovered these. And what they were recording from here, and basically when you present a tray with a peanut or a piece of fruit to the monkey, it goes and, in this case, uses a precision pinch, and then certain monkeys will be active when there's a precision pinch, but not for other types of manual skill. And so you see over 10 trials, there's very vigorous activity each time the monkey grabs it, and then here's a histogram to prove it. But when I think it was Leo, was placing, using a precision pinch, the fruit on the tray before handing it to the monkey, the oscilloscope drove the loudspeaker, started burping away, not quite as fast, but this. And that was the discovery of mirror neurons. Neurons for specific subclasses of action that elicit activity, both when executing the action and when observing someone else execute the action. There's a lot of other neural machinery inside this area, F5 of the brain, but the important point is that there's this idea of mirror neurons. And now in humans, except in rare cases of neurosurgery, we can't look at what individual neurons are doing. So what we can say is, here's an area of the brain that when we do brain scans and against some control condition, this will light up for one group of movements, whether during execution or during observation. So here's the hand mirror neuron, the manual action mirror neuron area. Here's the disgust emotion mirror area, and so on. But it's a system rather than what individual neurons are contributing. But I want to show you one result that I think qualifies what many people think about mirror neurons. So this is a study by Buccino from Parma and colleagues on neural circuits involved in the recognition of actions performed by non-conspecifics. So in each case, they're looking at the brain scans of a human, but in one case, they're showing them videos. I've just given you samples here of a human biting, a monkey biting, and a dog biting. And in this case, you're meant to look at this and be convinced that in this case, we're seeing mirror neuron activity in each case. We're recognizing this as an action in our own repertoire, and the brain is lighting up for that. However, over here, they have three cases where these are no soundtrack, but a human speaking, a mouth, sort of orofacial communicative gestures from a monkey, and barking by a dog, and then watching the human, a lot of mirror neuron activity, not so much mirror neuron activity for the monkey, and none for the dog. And the crucial point is that we recognize all those actions perfectly well. So it's not that you need mirror neurons to recognize an action. The idea is that somehow it's to recognize the appropriate parameter setting for that action within your own repertoire. So you can sort of map that in. And the experiment I wish they'd done is that if they'd said, instead of just watching it, they'd ask them to prepare to imitate the action, I think that you would have got much more here than you would get here, because in that case, we're pretty good at imitating like that. So what I think is that there's a bit like this ventral dorsal distinction. I think the ventral system can recognize actions perfectly well by itself, but it takes that dorsal system to map it onto our own actions to provide finer parametric distinction. And There's some stories about baseball players and soccer players, but I won't do that. Okay. Finally, for this, I've got till 6, right? 20 minutes, is that correct? I think I'm just going to say screw this half of the lecture and move on to the second half at this rate. Anyway, so the important point for the general theory that you're not going to hear all of this afternoon is that mirror systems don't support imitation. Remember, what the mirror system is defined as, if this action is in my repertoire, then I've got neurons that will fire both when I observe the action and when I perform the action. But if we learn by imitation, that says specifically that there's an action that's not in our repertoire, and somehow we've got to recognize it as something we would like to achieve and add to our repertoire. So that means there has to be some way the brain can import stuff into the repertoire rather than just simply registering, oh, that looks like something I can do. So I think this is the point where I just show you 73 slides. No, actually I'm going to show you about 20 and pick one of them. So this is observing imitation in chimpanzees. This is the fact that apes can learn new gestures. This is the fact that that F5 area where they found the mirror neurons for grasping is homologous to Broca's area, which is traditionally thought of as a speech production area in humans. And if you want to understand that, the person to turn to is Ursula Belugi, who was a linguist, well, she still is, but was working on originally child development, and then moved into the study of sign language. And what she discovered with her colleagues, Klima, her husband, and Poisner, was that if you found rare people who were native signers, whether it was American or British or any other sign language, but they had their first data were on American sign language, who had brain lesions in Broca's area, then they would become aphasic. And so a person like that could no longer mobilize sign language, but they could still pantomime. So instead of coming up with the signs for flying, for example, they would pantomime flying around. Just observe the beauty of the knowledge that will never be yours unless you read the book. They'll be signing during the break. So anyway, the key idea is that the imitation exhibited by monkeys is very limited. It's fairly good in apes, but it's more, oh, I see what you're doing, let me try to do it, rather than looking at the subtleties of the movement and trying to factor the observation of the movement into the performance. And so this, with that explanation, will be the big theory. Pre-hominid, we have grasping and a mirror system for grasping in our last common ancestor with the monkey. We progress to a simple imitation system for grasping in the chimp. By that time, we have a fixed set of vocalizations, essentially, but a slightly open set of manual gestures for communication. Then I claim we have the ability to recognize complex actions and imitation. Now, what does that mean? The complex action recognition saying if I see a behavior, I can become pretty good at breaking it into parts and seeing both what each part is doing. Apes can sort of do that, but also getting a sense of what was the motion to do it. And imitation then is to try to replicate those parts. And then the idea is that whereas the monkeys there had to do it all by trial and error, the humans get to the stage where they can ratchet up, as Tomasello says, to build on previous actions to very quickly acquire new behaviors. Then the idea is that brings us to naive pantomime. So that it's a crucial thing that the monkey behavior with the hands is basically needs an object to act upon. Whereas we move through gestural systems and then into the human pantomime to getting less and less dependence on the object. We're not trying to manipulate the object anymore. We're trying like this drinking from a cup sort of thing where you get the message without there being any cup in my hand or any fluid in the non-existent cup. So now The next stage is proto-sign, going from pantomimes, which are, take a long time to perform, take a lot of energy, and may be ambiguous, to a group agrees to conventionalize them. So, and then the claim is, once that begins to grow, then there becomes an adaptive advantage in beginning to get more control of the vocal system to add vocal gestures to the manual gestures. And this expanding spiral is just to make the point that I'm not saying you go all the way to sign language and then suddenly you say, oh, we're sick of sign language, let's switch to spoken language. The other is long before you get to language, when you're just laying the foundations for proto-language, at that stage is when you begin to bring in the vocal control. So let me just switch to the 20th century to give you one example from ASL, which, although obviously not what our distant ancestors were doing, I think gives you some sense. So if I, forgive my accent, but this is sort of a hand shape that represents an aeroplane. So if I do this, is that the airplane? Is it the flying? Or is it the conjoint airplane and flying? So what ASL did was say, let's convert this, which might originally be just a pantomime, which is very ambiguous, and say, well, if you make the sign but you do this, then that's the airplane bit. And if you do this trajectory with that hand shape, then that's the flying. And now I can talk about airplanes on the ground and wrecked airplanes and things of this kind because I've separated the flying and the airplane. But this was by a conventionalization, which you might think, well, look, the damn thing's moving. So that means flying. And wow, look at it go. That's an airplane. So it's dependent upon the group's shared convention. So I am just going to, so beautiful, so sad. Oh, but I promise construction, so construction you shall have. Now, you're all experts on this system. So this is just to remind you of this exquisite blending of getting the picture. Hey, you know, put the nut on the anvil and pick up the hammer and crack away on the one hand, or the two hands in this case, and what have I got left? On the other beak, to prepare for the next talk, I've got this fine coordination of visual input and motor output. So we're a little bit like that ventral dorsal thing I was talking about before. So to emphasize again, as we analyze behaviors, we've got this sort of event level. What are the events? What are the actions? What comes before? What comes after? And then we've got what I'll call the trajectory level. A very nice example from Dave Lee at Edinburgh University was studying the long jump, also known as the broad jump, where optic flow is being used to estimate time until contact. So the flow of information on the retina as you run up towards the board is providing the ability to estimate how long will it be. And what he finds is there's immense variation in the length of the strides from time to time until that last stride, which is precisely controlled by the expert. So the foot lands just on the board. If you're behind it, you're losing distance across the sand. If you're over it, you lose the jump. So it's interesting this way, I think, of another study was gannets diving, where the gannet's coming down to the water to get a fish that sees below, and it folds its wings at just the right moment. So, and Dietrich Stout is fantastic, as you've all known from his sparkling introductions today, and perhaps some of you have read his sparkling papers as well. This is so frustrating. If it's any consolation, there are only 80 slides here, and 2 days ago there were 370. So consider yourself well off that you're not missing out, obviously, as much. All right, so anyway, so this is a horrible oversimplification, but what Dietz has done is be part of a community that has gone through various sites to find what is an older technology, now known as the Olderwan technology, where basically the napping, the hitting one stone with another, is designed to remove a flake, and the aim is to get a good flake that you can use as a tool. And then you move to the Acheulean technology, where your removal of flakes is to end up with a tool from the core. So you can see from here, this is what's left over after you've removed flakes. Relatively small brain, then you end up with more and more beautifully shaped stone axes. And then beyond that, you get to the stage where you begin to assemble things. So that's sort of the transition from Dori via Dietz to construction, because you get to hand axes where you've got to craft a handle and the axe head, and you've got to find some way, whether it's you of putting them together, perhaps with thongs. Around the same time, people are discovering how to make glue, which is interesting because you're really getting into chemistry. So that is a whole new domain. So this is where I make a feeble effort, published in the 2011 Annual Review of Anthropology, to try and create some ideas of contact between what skills must be in the Olduan technology, where you've got the manual precision, but it's different from the Acheulean technology, where in some sense you are aiming towards a final form. And so part of the discussion that we're having between a small group with the bird nests and so on is how much of what you're doing is, or what the bird is doing, is based on an image of the final result versus, hey, I'm just doing my thing here, and that through earlier experience has proved to be useful to getting there. I was going to show you slides concerning the last time and first time I cooked a recipe based on Israeli couscous and eggplants, but I won't. But what's interesting is reflecting on that in terms of this discussion, what I was struck by were several things. Firstly, how amazing it is that we can go to our supermarket or go online and get all these exotic materials from all around the world. And some of you know G.K. Chesterton, and he had a book called The Napoleon of Notting Hill, where there was a, forget Brexit, this was the different boroughs of London trying to become independent entities, and the hero, the Napoleon of Notting Hill, was admiring all the different products in the grocer's store around 1900 that had come from the tea all the way from China and so on. So the fact that we live in a situation where we're not in terms of a catchment area of 20 kilometers, but a global catchment area, that's already amazing. And then the next thing is that we're assuming that we have a stove and all those utensils we need to cook it. And then finally, I'm very proud of the fact that I cooked it successfully the first time, but only because in this case, going back to our two levels, I could use language to follow what each stage was, but each stage was invoking a skill I already had rather than requiring me to master the sensory motor tuning to be able to handle that piece. But now, finally, back to why I made this diversion, is most of the stages of the recipe, I wasn't really thinking about the final dish. This is mix this, stir that. And so that issue, there's sort of a general framework, whether it's unwritten, as in the case of most behaviors, most of us take a shower or a bath without having consulted a recipe book on the steps involved, but we learned it. And so what we're doing, but I can't remember, did I shampoo what little hair is left or not? But okay. But you get the idea, I think, that that it really is a fascinating topic which we hope to approach, of saying when you have a very complex behavior, where are you consciously working towards the end goal, and that is shaping what you're doing earlier, versus you have learned, hey, I've got to do this to get ready, and then I'll do that to get ready, and that leads only late in the piece to the stage where you're finally saying, oh, it's almost ready. Now, I know what I've got to do. I don't want to burn that. I've got to serve it and things of this kind. Lots of interesting stuff about tool use here, but hey, you've heard from the master, so why add? Well, I will mention this interesting thing because this is the one a fascinating connection between tool use and neural data. So this is from the work of Atsushi Ariki, originally from Tokyo, but I think now in Singapore. One of his interesting attributes is that he's both very cosmopolitan and European in some ways, but also very Japanese in others. So one of his best friends is a grade 3 living treasure for practice of the no drama, N-O-H. But I digress. Okay, so what we're looking at here is a monkey. And here we're looking at we're trying to look at neurons whose receptor field is in the hand, and they can respond both to touch when something contacts the hand, but also to seeing the object in relation to the hand. And here is a bimodal neuron that is active for touch in this area, but also can respond to looking at an area that the activity in this will yield contact with. And what he shows is that for the hand neuron, this is the region where you have to see the object to activate it. But for the shoulder region, this is the area. So in other words, anywhere you can move with the shoulder in this position, anywhere you can grab with the hand in this position. But now teach the animal to use a rake, and it takes a lot of effort, then the hand-sensitive neuron extends its visual receptive field all the way out to the rake. So it's sort of the whole area which the, if you will, the extended hand can manipulate. But when he stops using the rake, the hand goes back to this stage. And similarly, when he learns to use the rake, we get this whole, instead of what he can reach with his hand from the shoulder without just the hand, now we get this whole region that he can rake is now extending the visual field of this. But again, it will go back. So this idea of the brain having this ability to acquire new skills that then change the properties of the constituent neurons for linking vision and action. But then as you go to another task, hey, I don't have the rake anymore, or I have some other tool, then we're going to get a different thing. So this is a fascinating area to explain, I think, to extend our understanding of tool use into the neural arena. 5 minutes, is that right? All right, well, okay. Horace Barlow, an expert on vision, explained to me how a hierarchical theory of extracting visual features to come up with contours could explain why we can recognize, if we're old enough, Alfred Hitchcock from this caricature. And I responded to him, Horace, how do I know you're not a caricature? And so that gets into the idea that we have both this hierarchical structure of abstraction that allows us to make contact with knowing what things are, and yet at the same time it's always enriched by those lower level details that give the process its vividness. And here's a wonderful theory that I wish I had time to tell you about on how that happens. But, all right. You recognize this gentleman, Peter Zumthor, who has wonderful thermal baths up in Valls in Switzerland. So here's something else he said. Not only the quote, construction is the art of making a meaningful whole out of many parts, but he reflected on his design process. He says, when I design, I frequently find myself sinking into old, half-forgotten memories. Yet at the same time, I know that all is new. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? And this, quite independently, has inspired several neuroscientists, among them this group, who wrote a paper called The Future of Memory, Remembering, Imagining in the Brain. And what they're doing is they're imaging people when they're remembering episodes in their life, and they're imaging people when they're trying to imagine certain things, and they find an overlap. Now, it's important. They sometimes talk as if it's the same system. It ain't, but it's an overlapping system. So that's the first part of the story, right? That there are systems that seem to be doing, in a way, what our friend Zumter is talking about, that you're bringing back memories, and that's feeding into your imagination. The problem with those theories, and what I think that theory of vision I didn't explain in detail does, is bring in the notion that a memory, if we just think of it as a visual image, without bringing in all the other associations, but just think about the visual image, it itself is a construct, right? You've looked at the scene, certain details stick in your mind, certain don't, you remember those. My memory will be the opposite of yours, because we're facing an opposite direction. But anyway, we will see various things. So you might think of this guy in front of the audience and a screen above and a few other details, and that's it. I'll be thinking about the disposition. I might even recognize some of your faces later. But the point is, once I get into imagination, some of that will come back, but then that association might make me think of something else. And then that'll make me think of something else. So then in the end, and this is, I think, the point, because each memory is itself a construct, I can make new imaginations by blending and forcing and putting these things together to meet certain criteria. So that's the notion there. And that's how we do it. The next part is linking vision and language. So this is just to show you we're making progress from the last time I showed part of this slide. And that's how we do it. So it's time to draw to a conclusion. Ha ha ha. Okay, Merlin Donald, who's one of the people who's thought about the origin of the modern mind, suggested that after humans had become anatomically modern, an important change via cultural evolution was the development of external memory, maybe 45,000 years ago. So the idea is that when we make a cave painting or a petroglyph or other things, we are in some sense extending our memory, and so that brings us all the way to the modern age where we have so many ways we can immensely expand our memory from the outside. But that's the beginning. And so that led me to ponder this idea, is the language-ready brain also drawing-ready? And so just look at it this way, again, anachronistic. Our distant ancestors of 45,000 years ago didn't drink coffee unless they lived in Ethiopia. And they didn't have coffee cups, probably. No, never mind. But what must be added to a brain that can lift a drink from a cup to get a brain that can draw the cup? What experience of a person with such a brain yields a capacity for drawing? And to short-circuit the slides, two different things. One is, we've talked about pantomime. And if you ask, does a language-ready brain support drawing, and you ask it of a Chomskyite, who just tells you about a universal grammar giving you very abstract rules for combining syntactic categories, sort of look at them, how could that be? But if you've come up through pantomime to get the manual gestures that have created the brain that could get to the stage of mastering a language that was both vocal and manual, co-speech gestures and all, and you came through pantomime to do it, then the idea that you can look at an object and trace its outline for communication as part of the pantomime package on the way to communication. So once technology catches up and says, instead of tracing these patterns of action in the air in an evanescent way that communicates, give me a stick of charcoal or something, and I can make those contours on the cave wall or somewhere else. So I think this provides a substrate. Now, what about adding color? Now, there's good evidence of the use of ochre at least 100,000 years ago. And the thought may be that at that stage, that was more for decorating the body. And that might be, this is pure speculation, inspired by noting the decoration of birds, trying to transfer it to the human body and so on. So once the technology was developed for putting contours in place, then there was another technology that could be combined with that of using color to begin to do this. So this is all I have time for. Getting from there to Turner is quite a stretch. And I have about 5 minutes on explaining this picture, but let me go all the way to this about the what and where thing. There are people with brain damage that seems to be such that I think they only have access to the how pathway and not the what pathway. So if you look at this result by one of these brain damaged people, shown on the right, using the model on the left, at first you think, wow, they can draw very well. I'm not sure I could have drawn it that well. But then if you look at the tail, you see it's not connected to the bird. And the end of the tail, not only unconnected to the rest of the tail, but they've got sort of mixed up with lines for drawing the stove. So the notion is this person is able to copy on a line-by-line basis because they're undisturbed by conveying the meaning, whereas we're thinking about, well, how do I draw a rooster? How do I draw a stove? And so our thing is the interaction of the how and the what. This is just pure. So this is just to fit some of the drawing stuff into our earlier framework. And so to conclude, this is an ape nest. And basically, you just bend a few branches, and you lie in it for the night. So the suggestion is that if we want to understand construction from an animal model, maybe we should move beyond primates and look to the birds. And thus, I suggest adding beculation to manipulation. And here's this wonderful logo by Philip Ziegler, who was very interested in the way in which pigeons can use their beaks for grasping. And so in conclusion, there is a wonderful talk coming up after the break. And the challenge that will worry us as we listen to the talk and as we ponder it in the days to come will be, on the one hand, if we look at the top row, we sort of get the idea of very species specific. So what's the genetic program that tells the birds how to build these things? And yet when we look at three different bird nests from blackbirds, we see a lot of variation. And so this gets us back to that challenging thing with any behavior of what is it that our brains must have to be ready for a certain class of behaviors? And then how far can we go with that brain in realizing those behaviors in varying environmental and social conditions? And so with that, I conclude. Thank you. Does anybody care to formulate a question? Oh dear. It's the trouble when you supply all the answers. Well, maybe I supplied too many questions. Okay, well, thank you all. And Sue, you can start setting up, I guess.
Well, we've got 10 minutes.